likely have been some reproductive advantages to ejaculating as quickly as possible during intravaginal intercourse, such as inseminating as many females as possible in as short a time frame as possible, or allowing our ancestors to focus on other adaptive behaviors aside from sex, or perhaps, under surreptitious mating conditions, doing the deed quickly and expeditiously without causing a big scene? Like so many things before, it turns out that this insight of mine was actually several decades behind the curve, because in 1984, when at 9 years of age I was still anything but a premature ejaculator, a sociologist named Lawrence Hong published a highly speculative but very original paper along these same lines that's worth engaging with here, fittingly titled Survival of the Fastest, on the origins of premature ejaculation. In this article, Hong, whose most recent work, as far as I can tell, has been on the global phenomenon of cabaret transgenderism, posited that during the long course of human evolutionary history, an expeditious partner who mounted quickly, ejaculated immediately, and dismounted forthwith might have been the best for the female. The empirical centerpiece of Hong's arriving at this conclusion is the fact that, on average, human males achieve orgasm by ejaculating just 2 minutes after vaginal penetration, whereas it takes the owners of these vaginas, on average, at least twice that long to do the same once a penis is inside of them, if they achieve orgasm at all, that is. This obvious gender mismatch between orgasm latencies can be understood, Hong reasons, only once we acknowledge that sex evolved, at least initially, for purely reproductive purposes. Don't forget, he reminds us, that recreational heterosexual sex is only enabled by relatively recent technological innovations, such as prophylactics and other contraceptive devices. Hong compares the mating habits of human beings with those of other rapid and not-so-rapid ejaculators in the primate family, noting that the faster a primate species is in the coital realm, the less aggressive it is when it comes to mating-related behaviors. He calls this the slow-speed, high-aggressiveness hypothesis. For example, male rhesus macaque monkeys often engage in marathon mounting sessions, where sex with a female can be drawn out for over an hour at a time, including many breaks and therefore non-continuous thrusting. That may sound great, but libidinous anthropomorphizers beware. Macaque sex is a chaotic and violent affair, largely because the duration of the act often draws hostile attention from other competitive males. By contrast, primate species whose males evolved to ejaculate rapidly would have largely avoided such internecine violence, or at least minimized it to a considerable degree. Key to Hong's analysis is the idea that intravaginal ejaculation latencies in males are heritable. There was initially greater within-population level variation in the male ancestral population, he surmises, but over time, the ancestry of Homo sapiens became overpopulated with rapid ejaculators. According to Hong, this is because young reproductive-aged males who ejaculated faster, that is, had more sensitive penises, avoided injury, lived longer, and therefore had a greater chance of attaining high status and acquiring the most desirable females. Hong's reasoning on these heritability grounds has in fact received recent support. You may have missed this in your monthly periodical readings, but in a 2009 article from the International Journal of Impotence Research, a team of Finnish psychologists led by Patrick Yern reported evidence from a large-scale twin study showing that premature ejaculation is determined significantly by genetic factors. Thousands of male twin pairs, fraternal and identical, completed a survey about how long it took them to reach orgasm. And the timing of identical twins was more closely matched than fraternal twins. So just as Hong surmised many years ago, this is indeed a heritable trait. If you doubt it, go on, have that awkward conversation with your fathers. In fact, since Yern and his colleagues found that delayed ejaculation, the other extreme end of the ejaculation latency continuum, revealed no such genetic contributions, these authors generally agree with Hong, postulating that premature ejaculation may be a product of natural selection, whereas delayed ejaculation would be completely maladaptive. Delayed ejaculators are considerably rarer, with a prevalence rate as low as 0.15% in the male population compared with as high as 30% with premature ejaculators, and their condition is usually owed to lifelong medical conditions or the recent use of anti-adrenergics, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, neuroepileptics, or other modern-day drugs that are often associated with anorgasmia as a miserably unfortunate side effect. Adding further credence to the evolutionary model is a separate set of self-report data published in the Journal of Sexual Medicine, in which Yern and his colleagues demonstrated that ejaculation latencies were significantly shorter when men achieve orgasm through vaginal penetration than when doing so in the course of other activities, such as anal, oral, or manual sex. In fact, in light of these differential ejaculation latencies, They argue that the very construct of such male orgasmic timing is best carved up by discrete sexual behaviors rather than treated as a more general clinical phenomenon. And they offer several helpful acronyms for these ejaculation latency subtypes too, such as OELT for oral ejaculation latency time, and conveniently MELT for masturbation ejaculation latency time. I have the niggling, faraway sense that we've left something out of the evolutionary equation regarding the variation in male ejaculation latencies. What, oh what, can that possibly conceivably be? Oh, come now, I know it's women's sexual satisfaction. Actually, Hong didn't leave female orgasms out of his rather viscous analysis altogether. He just didn't see them as being central to selective pressures. Presumably, like other theorists of that time writing about the biological reasons for female orgasms, such as Stephen Jay Gould, who thought that female orgasms were much like male nipples, a happy leftover of the human embryological bow plan, he saw women's sexual pleasure as being a nice but neither here nor there feature of human sex that nature had thrown into the mix. Hong acknowledges, with great humility and humor, in fact, that his ideas on the evolutionary origins of premature ejaculation in human males are mostly guesswork, and his ideas were critiqued by the psychologist Ray Bixler in his review of Hong's theory. Among many faults that Bixler finds in Hong's survival of the fastest theory, the basic logic just doesn't mesh with the obvious female pursuit of sexual intercourse. In chimpanzees, for instance, a species for which male ejaculation latencies are measured in seconds, not minutes, it is often females who initiate mating behaviors. And then there's the ouch factor of having a non-aroused female partner whose dry genitals aren't terribly inviting. If Hong's model were correct, says Bixler, there would be little or no proximal cause other than coercion for female cooperation. And it should be very clear that she would have to cooperate if voluntary mating were to be speedy. If she were not lubricated, he writes, he would have to rasp it in, a painful experience for the woman, and no pleasure for him either. Disappointingly, this is more or less where the evolutionary thinking stops on the subject. Apparently no other theorist, at least no experimentally inclined evolutionary theorist, has picked up Hong's lead in trying to tease apart competing adaptationist arguments regarding male ejaculation latencies. Pieces of the puzzle are floating about out there, I suspect, such as the Finnish research showing that vaginal sex leads to faster ejaculation compared with other sexual behaviors. But Hong's article was before its time, premature itself, in light of today's more informed evolutionary biology, which is now poised to construct a more nuanced empirical model about this evolutionary legacy that is behind so many of us being fast finishers. Another big piece of the puzzle may be linked to our species' uniquely evolved social cognitive abilities. Possibly only tens of thousands of years ago, just a splinter of a splinter's time in the long course of our primate history, ancestral humans may have become the only species capable of experiencing empathy with our sexual partners during intercourse. Men could then think about satisfying their partners during sex rather than just themselves, thus deliberately prolonging the act of coitus to delay their own orgasm for her sake. Prior to this, our more distant ancestors may have been more like chimpanzees, seeing others' bodies as mindless meat. Given the unpleasant stigma attached to premature ejaculation, an evolutionary approach to the problem could greatly inform clinical treatment, a not surprisingly high-grossing therapeutic area in which there is no shortage of work being done. But in any event, Hong's seminal idea should give us all pause in labeling any particular intravaginal ejaculation premature. Mother Nature, arguably the only lover that really matters after all, may very well have had a thing for our one-minute ancestors. An ode to the many evolved virtues of human semen. I have come upon a secret treasure, a heretofore unknown bounty of facts only recently unearthed by a team of evolutionary psychologists. A vital forewarning, though. Although the data and information I am about to share oozes with the promise of dramatically improving virtually every aspect of your well-being, it can also be abused with tragic, even fatal, consequences. This is so much the case, in fact, that I debated the merits of popularizing this material, and do so here only with great circumspection and caution. So please be wise in digesting this semen-related knowledge, and be wiser still in applying it to your own sex lives. As with the origins of so many great scientific discoveries, this story begins with a serendipitous chain of events. Our interest in the psychological properties of semen arose as a byproduct of an initial interest in menstrual synchrony, explained the co-discoverers Gordon Gallup and Rebecca Birch, writing about human semen. In particular, Gallup and Birch had stumbled onto a set of curious data from the mid-1990s, showing that unlike heterosexually active women residing together, partnered lesbians sharing a residence failed to exhibit the well-known McClintic effect, in which menstrual cycles in cohabiting women as well as those of females from many other species, are synchronized. Since subtle olfactory cues called pheromones are known to mediate menstrual synchrony, write the authors, this struck us as peculiar, because lesbians would be expected to be in closer, more intimate contact with one another on a daily basis than other females who live together. What is it about heterosexual females that promotes menstrual synchrony? Or conversely, what is it about lesbians that prevents menstrual synchrony? It occurred to us that one feature that distinguishes heterosexual women from lesbians is the presence or absence of semen in the female reproductive tract. Lesbians have semen-free sex. Perhaps you already see where this is leading. Gallup and Birch reason that certain chemicals in human semen, through vaginal absorption, affect female biology in such a way that women who have condomless sex literally start to smell different from those women, lesbians or otherwise, who do not. At least, bodies of the former emit pheromones that entrain menstrual cycles among cohabiting women. Their hunch was indeed borne out as they reviewed the existing literature on menstrual synchrony. But this happenstance discovery of asynchronous lesbians was just the tip of the semen iceberg for Gallup and Birch, who quickly discovered that although much was known among biologists about basic semen chemistry, virtually nothing was known about precisely how these chemicals might influence female biology behavior and psychology. And that is a rather odd omission in the biological literature indeed, since there could hardly be anything more obvious in Darwinian terms than the fact that semen is, almost by definition, naturally designed to get into the chemically absorptive vagina. Bear in mind that although they are often conflated in everyday parlance, along with many other less scientific terms, semen is not the same thing as sperm. In fact, you may be surprised to learn that only about 1-5% of the average human ejaculate consists of sperm cells. The rest of the ejaculate, once drained of these famous flagellating gametes, is referred to as seminal plasma. So when one discusses the chemical composition of semen, it is the plasma itself, not the spermatozoa, that is at issue. Now, medical professionals have known for a very long time that the vagina is an ideal route for drug delivery. This is because the vagina is surrounded by an impressive vascular network. Arteries, blood vessels, and lymphatic vessels abound. And unlike some other types of drug administration, chemicals that are absorbed through the vaginal walls have an almost direct line to the body's peripheral circulation system. So it makes infinite sense, argue Gallup and Birch, that like any artificially derived chemical substance inserted into the vagina via medical pessary, semen might also have certain chemical properties that tweak female biology. It turns out that this insight, so obvious as to be all but invisible, has been a theoretical goldmine for this hawk-eyed pair of adaptation-minded thinkers. But before we jump into their rich vat of seminal theory, let's have a quick look at some of the key ingredients of human semen. In fact, semen has a very complicated chemical profile, containing over 50 different compounds, including hormones, neurotransmitters, endorphins, and immunosuppressants, each with a special function and occurring in different concentrations within the seminal plasma. Perhaps the most striking of these compounds is the bundle of mood-enhancing chemicals in semen. There is good in this goo. Such anxiolytic chemicals include, but are by no means limited to, cortisol, known to increase affection, estrone, which elevates mood, prolactin, a natural antidepressant, oxytocin, also elevates mood, thyrotropin-releasing hormone, another antidepressant, melatonin, a sleep-inducing agent, and even serotonin, perhaps the best-known antidepressant neurotransmitter. Given these ingredients, and this is just a small sample of the mind-altering drugs found in human semen, Gallup and Birch, along with the psychologist Stephen Platick, hypothesized rather boldly that women having unprotected sex should be less depressed than suitable control participants. To investigate whether semen has antidepressant effects, the authors rounded up 293 college females from the SUNY Albany campus who agreed to fill out an anonymous questionnaire about various aspects of their sexual behavior. Recent sexual activity without condoms was used as an indirect measure of seminal plasma circulating in the woman's body. Each participant also completed the Beck Depression Inventory, a commonly used clinical measure of depressive symptoms. The most significant findings from this study, published with criminally modest fanfare in the Archives of Sexual Behavior, were these. Even after adjusting for frequency of sexual intercourse, women who engaged in sex and never used condoms showed significantly fewer depressive symptoms than did those who usually or always used condoms. Importantly, these chronically condomless, sexually active women also evidenced fewer depressive symptoms than did those who abstained from sex altogether. By contrast, sexually active heterosexual women, even really promiscuous women, who used condoms were just as depressed as those practicing total abstinence. In other words, It's not just that women who are having sex are simply happier, but happiness appears to be a function of the ambient seminal fluid pulsing through one's veins. Relax, settle down, take a deep breath. I know what you're thinking. This is a correlation study, and there are scores of other possible causes and explanations. Both those that the authors anticipated and controlled for in the study design. By all means, read the original work for more details. But note that these between-group differences in depression panned out even after controlling for the use of oral contraceptives, days since last sex, frequency of sex, and duration of the relationship with the male partner, and probably some that you can come up with on your own. Even the authors urge some degree of skepticism. It's important to acknowledge that these data are preliminary, they write, and correlational in nature, and as such are only suggestive. More definitive evidence for antidepressant effects of semen would require more direct manipulation of the presence of semen in the reproductive tract, and ideally the measurement of seminal components in the recipient's blood. Now, I'm hedging here, but one thing I do want to mention, with a helpful nod from the authors of this study, is that the antidepressant effects of seminal plasma may not be limited to vaginal absorption of its mood-brightening chemical properties. It would be interesting to investigate, Wright Gallup and his co-authors, the possible antidepressant effects of oral ingestion of semen or semen applied through anal intercourse, or both, among both heterosexual couples as well as homosexual males. So in my plumbing of the empirical literature for studies on unprotected anal sex among gay males, otherwise known as barebacking, I came across a load of research on this very topic. Most of this work is couched, understandably so, in the HIV prevention literature. One particularly telling study, though, comes from a 2005 report from the journal Nursing Inquiry, in which the Canadian investigators Dave Holmes and Dan Warner interviewed barebacking gay males, not while they were engaged in the act, but through later introspection, about their motivations for preferring unprotected anal sex over condoms in light of the obvious dangers of infection. The most intriguing result to emerge from this study in the context of Gallup and Birch's overall theoretical perspective regarding the psychobiology of semen was that so many of the barebacking interview subjects viewed the exchange of semen through unprotected anal sex as providing them with a palpable sense of connectedness with their same-sex partners, one that happened only with the internally unimpeded ejaculation. Unfortunately, rather than investigate the possible psychobiological effects of semen exchange in this dynamic, Holmes and Warner leer through a fairly typical postmodernist lens to explore the symbolic nature of semen exchange in barebackers. Now, I ask you, which is the more informative paradigm for understanding why gay men would practice unsafe sex through unprotected anal intercourse? An evolutionary biological account taking into consideration the chemical composition of seminal plasma and its possible effects on attachment among gay men, or a symbolic postmodernist perspective like the following one advanced by Holmes and Warner? In all fairness, this is just a snippet of what they have to say, but it's a good taste of their approach. The body becomes the locus of never-ending fights, write the authors, a carnal battlefield. The escape route, lines of flight, is intrinsic to the deterritorialization of the body without organs through which one becomes someone else. However, the lines of flight, they continue, could have paradoxical effects. Indeed, they can be avenues of creative potential, or conversely, paths of great danger. Yet, it is always in a line of flight that we create, that we must continue to experiment with such lines. Lines of flight, nuclei of resistance of re-singularization and heterogenesis, permit freedom to surge through a process of creative transformation and metamorphosis. Trust me, even in context, that reads as if the authors were cobbling together a Braille sentence using the random distribution of acne on someone's back. Sorry to sound a bit testes or testy, but while such soupy postmodernist rhetoric may still have its place in certain scholarly circles, when one is dealing with something as clinically important as unprotected sex among vulnerable populations, a scientific understanding of these people's motivations is essential before any intervention of their high-risk behaviors can even begin to occur. You may also be beginning to realize the dangers that I alluded to at the start of this essay. For both men and women, heterosexual and homosexual, knowing that the penis is capable of dispensing a sort of natural Prozac, whether obtained vaginally, anally, or orally, without also considering the viral arms race involving sexually transmitted infections, can lead to very tragic decisions indeed and many undocumented high-risk private bedroom semen experiments. But here's just one reason to put the brakes on such plans. The HIV virus, which evolved long after these adaptive antidepressant factors, has apparently come to pirate human semen, such that certain protein factors in seminal plasma, particularly a protein called prostatic acid phosphatase, make HIV up to 100,000-fold more potent than it is outside of the plasma. In any event, Gallup and Birch's model also reminded me of those off-sited Papua New Guinea tribes, such as the Sambia, and their semen ingestion rituals involving young boys. On the surface, there's a puzzling scenario here. Such cultures have long histories of being embroiled in violent warfare, and thus they tend to place extraordinarily high value on expressed masculinity. Yet ritualized homoerotic practices involving young boys fellating older males in order to ingest their semen are common. In an issue of the Archives of Sexual Behavior, Gilbert Hurt, a cultural anthropologist who studied the Sambia, along with his colleague Martha McClintock, the same McClintock named for the menstrual cycle synchrony effect discussed earlier, describes how, by the age of 11 to 12, Sambia boys have become aggressive fellators who actively pursue semen to masculinize their bodies. In the past, cultural anthropologists such as Hurt have conceptualized this semen ritual mostly in symbolic terms. Yet since testosterone from the seminal plasma could penetrate the oral mucosa, along with a surfeit of other hormones and chemicals having possible spin-off effects on male behavior, it is not inconceivable to me that there may be genuine psychobiological consequences of semen intake occurring in these young swallowing males that are not wholly out of line with the Sambia's own folk beliefs. It might not be a theory you want to run by your local pastor or bring up at your next PTA meeting, but you get the idea. But let's get back to more everyday semen ingestion. Maybe not every day, but you know what I mean. In addition to their semen as antidepressant model, Gallup and Birch have worked out many other intricate, persuasive arguments about how the various chemicals in human semen served and continue to serve biologically adaptive functions for both sexes. For example, among the more curious ingredients in human semen are follicle-stimulating hormone, FSH, and luteinizing hormone, LH. This is curious, Gallup and Birch point out, because these are distinctively female hormones. What are female hormones doing in human semen? The authors speculate that the presence of FSH and LH in human semen is related to concealed ovulation in human females. Unlike females of other primate species, women do not have breeding patterns governed by season or standardized cycles, and there are no obvious signals such as fire engine red swollen rear ends, giving away their time of the month. So for a naive human male, impregnating a woman as a consequence of sexual intercourse is much more a roll of the dice than it is for males of other species in their mating behaviors. Just as with any other species, though, getting the timing right so that release of semen coincides with the release of eggs is key. As a counterdefense against women's concealed ovulation, male evolution had a trick up its sleeve, which was the ability to manipulate the timing of a woman's ovulation to suit a man's own insemination schedule. That is to say, semen chemistry gives premature eggs a nice little nudging. Hence, the conspicuous presence of FSH, which causes an egg in the ovary to ripen and mature, and LH, which triggers ovulation and release of that egg. In support of this theoretical claim about semen chemistry and concealed ovulation in human females, consider that chimpanzee semen lacks the FSH hormone altogether, and the presence of LH is rather negligible, which makes sense, of course, since chimpanzees are cyclical breeders and ovulating females display their own personal red light district signs by way of swollen, multicolored anogenital regions. Thus it would appear, reasoned Gallup and Birch, that the chemistry of human semen has been selected to mimic the hormonal conditions that control ovulation, and as such may account for instances of induced ovulation, which means ovulation triggered by copulation at points in the menstrual cycle when ovulation would otherwise be unlikely. Believe it or not, we've only scratched the surface of the evolved semen literature. Here's a snapshot of other recent findings from Gallup's lab, most needing further investigation before we jump to any strong conclusions. Semen-exposed women perform better on concentration and cognitive tasks. Women's bodies can detect foreign semen that differs from their long-term or recurrent sexual partner's signature semen, an evolved system that Gallup believes often leads to unsuccessful pregnancies via greater risk of preeclampsia, because it signals a disinvested male partner who is not as likely to provide for the offspring. Women who had unprotected sex with their partners, and therefore were getting regularly inseminated by them, experienced more significant depression on breaking up with these men than those who were not as regularly exposed to an ex's semen. And they also go on the rebound faster in seeking new sexual partners, which presumably would help fix their semen-deprived depression. And the list goes on. Before I bid adieu, please accept, ladies, in all sincerity, my humblest apologies for what is likely to be a flood of inappropriate remarks from men saying, "I'm not a medical doctor, but my testicles are licensed pharmaceutical suppliers. I'm just the merry messenger." Part 2. Bountiful Bodies. The hair down there. What human pubic hair has in common with gorilla fur? Like many people, I ask myself continuously about some of life's biggest mysteries. Why are we here? What is the meaning of life? Why do we have those strangely sparse, wiry little hairs growing around our genitals? Hair that is singularly different from all the other hair in our bodies. Fortunately, scientists have managed to put my mind at rest on at least one of these daunting existential questions. In recent years, it seems, researchers have made some tremendous advances in the study of pubic hair. So let's start off with what we already know about pubic hair. It's a signature of sexual maturity, sprouting up around our groin sometime in early adolescence. If it appears on a person's body any time earlier than this in development, say prior to the age of 9 years old, something is clearly the matter. Some things just don't go together in this world. Babies and pubic hair is definitely one of them. Precocious puberty is no laughing matter, of course, because children who begin to develop secondary sexual characteristics unusually early in their development may in fact have some significant underlying health problems, such as a lesion on the central nervous system that prematurely activates the hypothalamus. But for one young couple in Alabama, the term precocious puberty hardly does justice to what they were observing with their infant son a few years ago. Just imagine changing your 6-month-old's diapers and noticing what appears to be a tuft of light-colored pubic hair on his groin. Over the next 10 months, the pubic hair would become progressively darker and adult-like, which, when accompanied by an oddly large penis for a 16-month-old and frequent erections, was finally enough to prompt this pair to seek medical advice. This was the background of the case as it was presented to a group of physicians that eventually reported it in Clinical Pediatrics. Upon examining the child, Samar Bomick and his colleagues noted with some astonishment that the pubic hair was that of an adolescent, mostly around the base of the phallus and was dark and curled. Further inspection revealed a healthy, bouncing baby boy, completely age-appropriate in all other respects, but the laboratory results indicated an abnormally high level of testosterone. Eventually, the doctors cracked the case. It turned out that the boy's father had been spreading testosterone gel twice daily over his shoulders, back, and chest, having been prescribed this treatment by his doctor to treat a low libido brought on by depression. Because the little boy slept in the same bed with his parents, with his father cuddling and hugging his child just after applying the gel, the bare skin contact was causing his son to become a man much earlier than nature intended. A follow-up visit later revealed, fortunately, that the pubic hair had all but disappeared once the father was made aware of this effect of his gel use, and the doctors were hopeful that the child would have no long-term complications from the testosterone exposure. This peculiar case of the pubic-haired infant is so striking, obviously, because this type of distinctive groin pelage tends to coincide with sexual maturation, not the developmental stage in which we're just learning how to walk. The case also highlights the oddity that is human pubic hair more generally. After all, we appear to be the only species of primate, perhaps the only species, period, that bears this type of strange hair around our genitals. Robin Weiss, a researcher from University College London's Division of Infection and Immunity, found himself standing in the shower one day, looking down and asking this very question. Weiss writes, "Although naked apes, humans, have pubic hair, surely our hairy cousins don't. How could I test my hypothesis? I knew that there was a stuffed chimpanzee in the Grant Zoological Museum at University College London," he says, "and I called in on the way to my laboratory. Alas, he was a juvenile, which left the question open. A brisk walk across Regent's Park to inspect the adult gorillas in their splendid new pavilion at London Zoo strengthened my suspicion, and this was later confirmed by a visit to the chimpanzees at Whipsnade Zoo, north of London. Indeed, all of the species of apes, old world monkeys and new world monkeys, seem to be less hairy in the pubic region than elsewhere. Fur is present, but it is short and fine." Weiss speculates that one of the main reasons that human beings uniquely evolved a thick bush of wiry hair around their genital regions is to visually signal sexual maturation. It also likely serves as a primitive odor trap and aids in the wafting of human pheromones. So pubic hair acts as a furry advertisement, indicating for prospective sexual partners that mating with that individual could potentially be a fruitful exercise in genetic perpetuity. Weiss believes that showing off our fecundity this way suggests pubic hair would have arisen only after we became naked apes, causing it to stand out so vividly against the backdrop of an otherwise hairless body. Another fascinating thing about pubic hair is its unusual texture and composition compared with the rest of the hair on our bodies and heads. You can't quite use it to floss with, trust me, but pubic hair is considerably thicker than either axillary, underarm hair, or that on our legs, chest, or for some people, their backs and scalps. I'm probably not the only one who shudders to think of an alternative path of natural selection, one in which the hair on our heads evolved to be of pubic proportions. Just consider what the average barbershop floor might look like at the end of the day. It's not entirely clear why pubic hair is so distinctly thick, short, and unusually curly. But the biologist Ann Clark from SUNY Binghamton did point out to me, while we were hiking on the Featherly and Furless Kapiti Island in New Zealand, which made it all the more memorable, that anything else would be rather impractical. To have long, flowing, stylish locks growing down there wouldn't be terribly convenient, especially given the logistics of sexual intercourse. But as Weiss points out, although pubic hair had its signaling advantages, it also came with a cost. And this cost goes by the name of thyrus pubis, more commonly known as crabs. The evolutionary story of crabs is remarkable, and it's one that Weiss relays in an issue of the Journal of Biology. If you've ever marveled at the similarity between human pubic hair and the coarse texture of gorilla fur, and let's face it, who hasn't, you're already on the right track. Weiss writes, on the basis of morphology, human thyrus pubis is closely related to the gorilla louse, Thylus gorillae. Molecular phylogeny indicates that human pubic lice diverged from gorilla lice as recently as 3.3 million years ago, whereas the chimp and human host lineage split from the gorilla lineage at least 7 million years ago. Thus, he says, it seems clear that humans acquired pubic lice horizontally, possibly at the time of the thyrus species split and probably directly from gorillas. Because they were already adapted to the coarse body hair of the gorilla, crabs would have found a suitable niche in human pubic hair. That's right, we got crabs from gorillas. But get your head out of the jungle gutter. Weiss speculates that our ancestors acquired these ravenous parasites not through interspecies sex, but as a consequence of ancient humans butchering and eating gorillas. This close contact with gorilla carcasses would have enabled the gorilla louse to jump host and mutate in accordance with the eventual evolution of human pubic hair, what must have seemed a cozy and familiar environment, to become the thyrus pubis species we know and loathe today. Much as bushmeat slaughter practices allowed retroviruses to invade humans from chimpanzees more recently. Regardless of how they came to be there, crabs have unfortunately become part and parcel of our species' pubis. Intriguingly, however, recent behavioral innovations in our species' cultural evolution, particularly modern grooming habits and the aesthetic stylizing of our pubic hair regions, have begun prying loose these pesky critters' grip on us. Some health clinics have noted a significant fall in the occurrence of pubic lice, especially among patients who shave all or some of their pubic hair. And even if only their sexual partners shave down there, the risk of acquisition in the patients themselves should still be substantially less than for those who mate with partners whose genitals are hidden in the type of thick cops that crabs delight in. This isn't an entirely new phenomenon. Prostitutes in medieval times would often wear merkins or pubic wigs after shaving their genitalia to help control their pubic lice. But before you go scheduling your next full Brazilian wax, consider that pubic hair does appear to offer some degree of protection against even nastier bacterial and viral infections. Although the diagnosis of pubic lice has seemingly plummeted as a direct result of human vanity in both sexes, cases of gonorrhea and chlamydia have increased over the same period, a correlation that may not be merely coincidental. Damned if you do shave, damned if you don't. Still, the hairlessness norm is gathering a lot of steam, particularly in Western countries. Several recent studies reveal just how common shaving one's nether regions has actually become. In an issue of Sex Roles, the Flinders University psychologists Marika Tigeman and Susanna Hodgson found that 76% of a sample of 235 female undergraduates from Australia reported having removed their pubic hair at some point in their lives. 61% currently did so, and half of the sample said that they routinely removed all traces of their pubic hair. The current trend for men appears to be no different. In a separate study the same year, with her colleagues Yolanda Martins and Libby Churchett, Tigeman reported in Body Image that of 106 gay men, 82% had removed their pubic hair at least once. Unless you think that this is just an artifact of gay male culture, straight men weren't far behind on this measure. Out of a sample of 228 heterosexual men, 66% reported doing the same. Irrespective of sexual orientation or gender, the investigators discovered that the primary motivation for pubic hair depilation is related to concerns with one's appearance, in contrast to health-related motivations. Let's also not forget that many individuals are put off by the idea of cunnilingus or fellatio because of those pesky pubic hairs that can lodge inadvertently in their gratifying throats. In fact, this was the theme of an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, where Larry David had to embarrassingly explain this bothersome tickle to a rather serious doctor. But now this is turning into a different type of story altogether. In any event, pubic hair coiffure is not a zero-sum game. Typing pubic hairstyles into my Google search bar yielded 467,000 hits at the time of this writing, every single one of which I was hesitant to click on, until I got home from the public library, of course. Bite me. The Natural History of Cannibalism. While I was strolling not so long ago through one of the dimly lit back rooms of a wing in the National Galleries of Scotland, my inner eyes still tingling with thousands of impressionistic afterimages, pudgy Rubensian cherubs, and Gothic quadrangles, one irreverent painting leaped out at me in a very contemporary sort of way. It was part of an early 16th century triptych showing what appeared to be a solemn middle-aged clergyman in gilded ecclesiastical robes commanding three naked adolescent boys before him in a bathtub. Now, I must say, my first thought on seeing this salacious image was that the Catholic Church has been an ephebophile's haven for far longer than anyone realized. But my uneasiness was put to rest once I leaned in to read the caption, which stated that the Dutch artist Gerard David, a prolific religious iconographer based in Bruges, Belgium, was merely painting a scene of starvation cannibalism. What a relief it was only an innocent case of anthropophagy, the eating of human flesh by humans, and nothing more sinister than that. The boys had been killed by a butcher, you see, and their carcasses were salting in a makeshift vat, awaiting ingestion by famished townspeople. Fortunately, that most notorious child lover himself, St. Nicholas, the middle-aged clergyman, just happened to be passing through town when he caught wind of the boy-eating scandal and resurrected the lads in the tub. In any event, my time in Edinburgh offered plenty of food for thought on the subject of human meat. From the art gallery, my partner Juan and I galloped over to the Surgeon's Hall Museum, where we wandered through aisles packed floor-to-ceiling with pickled gangrenous feet, hairy severed arms of industrial-age elderly women, trephined heads, and a sundry of sickly genitals. Also on display was an elegant leather notebook composed of a substance resembling cowhide, but in fact made of the skin of the famous corpse supplier coombe murderer William Burke. And all of this got me thinking about the logistics of cannibalism. The slick commercialization of the food industry has changed things dramatically, but there were at one time relatively frequent conditions, crop failures, habitat depletion, famine, in which cannibalism would have had life-saving adaptive utility for our species. One pair of anthropologists, for example, actually crunched the numbers, concluding that the average human adult provides 66 pounds of edible food, including fat, connective tissue, muscle, organs, blood, and skin. Protein-rich blood clots and marrow are said by the rare connoisseur to be special treats. At least one prominent evolutionary theorist, Louis Prichinovich, has argued that cannibalism is a genuine biological adaptation common to all human beings, including those of you gripping the toilet seat as you're hearing this. Anthropophagy routinely emerges, says Petrinovich, under predictable starvation conditions, and at least during our early evolution, human cannibalism was not as rare as you might think. Today, the term cannibalism conjures up sensationalistic stories of helicopter crashes in remote montane regions in the Andes, serial killers, or failed 19th century expeditions to the Arctic. But our deeper history suggests that it would not have been an entirely uncommon occurrence. The point is that cannibalism is in the human behavioral repertoire, writes Petrinovich in his The Cannibal Within, and probably is exhibited for a number of reasons, a common one being severe and chronic nutritional deprivation. A behavior might be exhibited only under extreme circumstances and still be part of our biological inheritance, and the fact that its course follows a systematic pattern argues against the hypothesis that it is psychotic in character. Petrinovich wends his way through a human history littered with the gnawed-on bones of our cannibalized ancestors, revealing that, contrary to critiques arguing that man-eating is a myth conjured up by Westerners to demonize primitives, we really have been gobbling each other up for a very, very long time. We're just one of 1,300 species for which intraspecific predation has been observed. Among primates, cannibalism can usually be accounted for by nutritional and environmental stress, or it appears as a reproductive strategy in which baboons, for example, consume unhealthy infants to make way for more viable offspring. Pinpointing the specific factors that cause cannibalism is a rather difficult affair in the laboratory, mainly because of those pesky university ethics review boards. Still, an intrepid Japanese researcher shrugged off these considerations and induced cannibalism among a captive population of squirrel monkeys by feeding the pregnant females a low-protein diet. This led to a high rate of spontaneous abortion and the mothers devouring their aborted fetuses, a much-needed bolus of protein. Now imagine doing this same study with human beings under similar controlled laboratory conditions. Rather horrific, I should say, but that doesn't mean the findings couldn't generalize to our own species. And don't get me started on the many ways that mammalian mamas feast on placental afterbirth. Some of our own prefer it with a dash of paprika, others as a spaghetti and meatballs dish. But the fact that cannibalism in primates, including human beings, is motivated by starvation is precisely the point that Petrinovich is arguing. Where he differs from other evolutionary theorists, however, is in his assertion that anthropophagy represents a true adaptation in our species, just as cannibalism does for other animals. It is not simply an anomalous behavior found in a handful of depraved individuals. Such people do exist, to be sure, like this man who is so curious to know what his own flesh tasted like that he... Well, I'll let the clinical psychiatrist who examined him tell you in their own words. After he cut the first toe, says the psychiatrist, he first showed it to his flatmates before he ate it raw while he walked the streets. He chewed as much of the bone as possible and then spat it out. He recalls eating it, quote, for the experience, and that it was a, quote, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to eat human flesh. He was excited by the shock value of doing so. The second toe was cooked in an oven before eating. In between cutting his toes, he continued to work on renovating houses. That man is presumably wearing special orthopedic shoes now, but again, whereas cannibalism can certainly be deviant, in other cases it's even somewhat routine. Our close cousins, the Neanderthals, were essentially carnivorous predators and were driven to cannibalism at the end of the last glacial maximum in the face of dwindling numbers of large game animals. Osteoarchaeological research at a cave in southeast France yielded a bundle of roasted Neanderthal bones from about 6 individuals, haphazardly discarded bones that had been deliberately defleshed and disarticulated in the marrow extracted. As for our own species, Aztecs were notorious for their bloodthirsty sacrifice and cannibalism rituals. These were largely symbolic religious events, but some scholars have suggested that the greasy surfeit of Aztec sacrifice victims may have also been a high-energy nutritional supplement for the wealthy elite, who had first dibs on this so-called man-corn. Actually, non-cannibals may be the outliers, both historically and cross-culturally speaking. Researchers have documented evidence of ritual anthropophagy throughout societies in Africa, including Zondaland, Sierra Leone, the Belgian Congo, South America, places such as eastern Brazil, Ecuador, western Colombia, Paraguay, the New Hebrides, such as Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, and the East New Guinea Highlands, and Native America. It's appeared in industrialized societies too, including famine-stricken China during the Great Leap Forward during the years 1958 to 62, and Soviet-era Russia. The bottom line, says Petrinovich, is that when you're hungry enough, ravenous really, and when all other food sources, including inedible things you'd rather not stomach, such as shoes, shoelaces, pets, steering wheels, rawhide saddlebags, or frozen donkey brains, have been exhausted and expectations are sufficiently low, even the most recalcitrant moralist among us would shrug off the cannibalism taboo and savor the sweet meat of man, or woman, boy, or girl, for that matter. It's either that or die, and between the two choices, only one is biologically adaptive. A behavior can be adaptive without being an inherited biological adaptation, of course. But because starvation occurred with such regularity in our ancestral past, and because the starving mind predictably relaxes its cannibalistic prescriptions, and because eating other people restores energy and sustains lives, and because the behavior is universal and proceeds algorithmically, we eat dead strangers first, then dead relatives, then live slaves, then foreigners, and so on, down the ladder to kith and kin, there's reason to believe, for Petrinovich at least, that anthropophagy is an evolved behavior. The taboo against cannibalism is useful in times of health and prosperity. Groups wouldn't survive very long if members were eating each other up, yet starvation has a way of releasing the cannibal within. In fact, some scientists have suggested that starvation cannibalism may have been so prevalent in the ancestral past that it literally changed our DNA. Modern human populations appear to contain genetic adaptations designed specifically to combat cannibalistic viruses. Typically, when a predator species consumes a prey species, there are substantive differences in immune systems between the two, with different varieties of pathogens. But the more similar the eater and the eaten, the more vulnerable the former to debilitating foodborne disease. This is because organisms can only be compromised by parasites that have adapted to the particular environment of the host species. They require a recognizable genetic substrate to thrive. According to the microbiologist Carlton Gajdoszek, who won the 1976 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for his epidemiological research in this area, this is what almost certainly happened with the New Guinea Foray people in the case of Kuru, a neurodegenerative disease that devastated that population in the early half of the last century. Gajdoszek traced the disease to mortuary cannibalism. Women and children were eating the brains of the recently deceased as part of the local funerary rites. Brain consumption was a ritual act, but it spiked in frequency, perhaps not coincidentally, whenever pork had fallen into short supply, so human brains also infused a dose of protein. The interesting thing is that Kuru is a variant of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and probably resulted originally from a single case of cannibalism among the Foray of a CJD-ridden brain, with Kuru then evolving on its own course. In an issue of Current Biology, the geneticist John Brookfield speculated that over the past 500,000 years, human beings developed increasing variation in the gene for the human prion protein. Those who are heterozygous for this gene, he points out, were protected against CJD through cannibalism. This sustained heterozygote advantage, he says, was possibly created by a lifestyle of habitual cannibalism, implying a new vision of the lifestyles of our ancestors. As we've seen, not all cases of cannibalism are due to nutritional needs. Sociopathic individuals such as Jeffrey Dahmer, Armin Muse, and Issei Sagawa lived in urban environments peppered with fast food restaurants and overflowing grocery stores, yet still they dined on people. In his book Super Sense, the psychologist Bruce Hood argues that such cases reflect essentialism beliefs, the idea that the victim's hidden essences or personality attributes are acquired by physical ingestion. It's also interesting that many such cases have a sexual component. As Margaret St. Clair wrote teasingly in the foreword of the book To Serve Man, A Cookbook for People, there's no form of carnal knowledge so complete as that of knowing how somebody tastes. I suspect there's some truth to that uncomfortable joke. Essentialism beliefs may account for our species' peculiar history of medical cannibalism as well. The conquistadors and their New World heirs were known to have used human fat from agile natives to grease their arthritic joints. Long before Armin Muse was even a twinkling in his mother's eye, pregnant Ake women of Paraguay were nibbling on boiled penises in the hopes that it would bring them sons. So with all of those scenes swimming in my head, and pragmatist that I am, I'm left wondering why exactly it is that the consumption of already dead human bodies is such a taboo, especially for societies in which the soul was commonly seen as flitting off at death like an invisible helium balloon. If you subscribe to such dualistic notions, after all, the body is only some empty shell that the now liberated spirit no longer needs. Even resurrectionists could gleefully feed the impoverished with their own flesh, lest they, God forbid, allow such a bounty of edible meat go to rot. All those wasted commercial goods burned down to sticky dust in crematories, squirreled away behind ornate vaults, fed extravagantly to bloated subterranean organisms. If you'd rather not eat meat from aged or possibly diseased dead people, and if you're worried about the dignity of the individual, it would be easy enough to breed and then factory farm brain-dead or free-ranging anencephalic human beings, treating them humanely, of course, but enforcing food safety standards to control for any outbreaks. After all, let us not forget those starving people of this world, surrounded by, as some epicures swear, the most succulent meat on the planet. The human skin condition, acne and the hairless ape. Humans are pimply. It's part of what sets us apart from the rest of the animal kingdom. While it's true that some form of acne vulgaris affects other species, it's been found in some Mexican hairless dogs and induced experimentally in rhino mice, acne is largely an affliction of our accursed species alone. Somewhere between 85 and 100% of adolescents exhibit acne, and a significant minority of adults, too. Why is the human animal so peculiar in its tendency to form volcanic blackheads, papules, pustules, nodular abscesses, and in some severe cases, lasting scars? According to the evolutionary theorists Stephen Kellett and Paul Gilbert, we probably owe these unsavory blemishes to our having lost our apish pelts too rapidly for our own good. Although increasingly glabrous, hairless skin evolved for adaptive purposes, it may have enabled our ancestors to keep cool, for example, while traveling across the hot savanna. The sure-footed pace at which genes for depilated flesh were selected posed some cosmetic problems. Kellett and Gilbert observed that the evolution of our sebaceous glands, which were accustomed to dealing with hair-covered flesh, lagged behind this change in our appearance. As a consequence, all that oily and waxy sebum, normally committed to lubricating fur, hadn't much fur to lubricate. So the sebum started to build up and clog our pores instead. There are many issues that a person suffering from hypertrichosis, also known as werewolf syndrome, has to worry about, but acne tends not to be one of them. Better this evolutionary account than pimples by intelligent design, in any event. What a heartless god indeed that would wind up the clock so that our sebaceous glands might overindulge in sebum production precisely at the time in human development when we'd become most acutely aware of our appearance. It only makes matters worse that evolution has given us another distinctly human trait, and one that makes any outbreak of acne infinitely more upsetting. I'm referring to our crippling sensitivity to other minds. Although this statement is not entirely without controversy, it seems likely, based on the available evidence, that other species do not share our fine-tuned facility at taking on the rich psychological perspective of others. If this is so, then seeing the flash of disgust or even a more innocent curiosity reflected in other human eyes whenever they steal away to our physical flaws triggers in us an aversive state entirely original to our species. Anyone who has ever had a ripe, loathsome pimple placed strategically upon the tip of her nose by the epidermal fates has felt this painful interpersonal state. Consider a scene from Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit, in which three strangers come to realize that they've just been cast to hell, which is, strangely enough, an average furnace drawing room. The devil's insidious rub, however, is that there are no windows, no mirrors, and no sleep permitted in this room. Even the characters' eyelids are paralyzed, disallowing them the simple luxury of blinking. Their exquisite little torture is for all eternity to be under one another's unrelenting glare. Inez, a sadistic lesbian, knows just how to push the buttons of the other female in the room. "What's that?" she asks, examining Estelle's face. "That nasty red spot at the bottom of your cheek. A pimple?" "A pimple?" replies the frantic, mirror-deprived, pampered debutante Estelle. "Oh, how simply foul!" Sartre's thonic allegory bears a striking resemblance, in fact, to the sort of living hell that many acne sufferers report experiencing on an everyday basis. For a report in the British Journal of Health Psychology, for instance, the psychologists Craig Murray and Catherine Rhodes interviewed around a dozen members of an online acne support group who'd been prescribed antibiotics or hormone treatments for their condition and suffered from acne for at least a full year. Michelle eloquently describes what it feels like to meet someone new face-to-face. She says, "I can feel the self-consciousness slowly consume me as the conversation progresses. Eventually, I cannot even retain my train of thought and become tongue-tied. I unravel. I do become overwhelmed at what others might be thinking. I don't usually assume what they might be thinking with any specificity. That would be too painful an endeavor. But I do give them a generalized voice. I acknowledge to myself that they have seen the acne and most likely think less of me due to its presence." Another woman, Laura, notes, "When I'm talking to people, I always stare them straight in the eye to watch if their pupils wander to other places on my face where I have a zit, and they usually do." Obviously, acne isn't just a female problem. It's arguably even worse for some males. One sufferer, Carl, explains why. "Society doesn't allow males to wear makeup, so we have to go out in the world in embarrassment. And if we tell people that we are feeling depressed or are concerned with our looks, we are looked down on as weak and pathetic, especially by other males." Speaking of thinking about others' thoughts, I know what you're thinking. Those who judge a book by its cover or ostracize a poor pimpled pal in these ways ought to be scorned in public themselves. I very much agree. But in spite of our sympathy, perhaps empathy, for those suffering,